From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall from our studio at UW La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining us today. Wisconsin Pride is a brand new documentary from our sister network of stations, PBS Wisconsin, public television stations all across the state of Wisconsin. And we're excited that that's coming out. And in order to talk about that from a Wisconsin perspective, but also more specifically from a southwestern Wisconsin perspective, we're joined by several guests today who have been involved in one way or another in the production of this new documentary, Wisconsin Pride. Let me first mention that the premiere of Wisconsin Pride is on Tuesday, the 20th of June. So that's this coming Tuesday. So tune in to that or check it out on the PBS Passport app or wherever it is you access the streaming version of PBS Wisconsin. Joining us today on Newsmakers, let me introduce Victor Marcias Gonzalez, who is the professor of history and women's gender and sexuality studies at UW La Crosse and participated in the documentary Wisconsin Pride. Victor, welcome to Newsmakers.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
We have Kristen Whitson with us as well. She's an author and archivist and is a co-author on We Will Always Be Here, a guide to exploring and understanding the history of LGBTQ plus activism in Wisconsin. Kristen, welcome to Newsmakers.
Thanks very much. Glad to be here.
Lauren Juno is a voice you've heard on this program before. Right now, she is with the La Crosse Community Foundation, and they have been an active partner in the production of this documentary in an all-important way. As media producers all know, it takes funding to get projects like this off the ground, and the La Crosse Community Foundation has supported this project in that important way. And Lauren also is very knowledgeable about the subject matter, and I'm looking forward to her perspective here today. Lauren, welcome to Newsmakers.
Thanks, Ezra. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. So we're talking about Wisconsin Pride, the documentary. We'll talk specifically about the documentary, the details of it in a moment, but just I'm more curious about the movement itself, LGBTQ life in Wisconsin itself. We'll start with you, Victor. When we talk about looking at the history of LGBTQ people in Wisconsin, how far back are we talking?
I think you can look at it as the very beginning. There's folks of having sex with folks of the same gender all the time. The big difference is, you know, at what point do they build an identity? What point do they build a community around that sex, right? So you can look at it beginning with Native Americans. You can look at it with frontiersmen, all single guys coming out here by themselves. Very clearly with immigration and with industrialization. Historians specifically like to explain how gay identity depends on the growth of cities and how cities provide opportunities for people that have different sexual behaviors to meet and to build community, right? And we especially we like to look at social spaces where people get together. It could be boarding houses, it could be bars, it could be, you know, that shady corner at the park where people hang out. Places where people that are attracted to the same gender find out they can meet other people like themselves. And, you know, it's documented very well on through court records, through photographs, through diaries, and, you know, and more recently, publications. You know, we've found an amazing collection of advertisements, for example, for drag performers in the 40s, the 50s. There's a lot of stuff, and, you know, lots of folks have gay relatives, and they have heard rumors, and these relatives die, and they uncover photographs and love letters and diaries, and some are smart enough to save them, and, you know, we have materials to work with as historians, and some are ashamed and don't know what to do and burn them, and, you know, what a shame, you know. So that might be why it's hard for us sometimes to come up with evidence and sources. You know, if you have a gay uncle, a gay aunt, a lesbian trans aunt, you hold on to their papers. Don't burn them. Don't throw them out. Don't be ashamed. Don't be silly. Save it. It's part of everyone's heritage.
You talked about even in Native American culture, in frontier people coming to this part of the country as settlers, but those people we don't think of sexuality in the same way in terms of like now we have labels for things and categories to put people in and so on, and that wasn't as publicly discussed. I get the impression anyway, in those days. Like how as a researcher do you learn about the sexual proclivities of frontier people, for example, if they wouldn't have necessarily been sort of advertising their involvement in that kind of community as openly?
Okay, so you have to be very smart to look at this. You're not going to find the word homosexual prior to 1969,
right,
for example, right? So what you do find is there's all kinds of labels that people have for folks that act differently, right? And so the first European explorers, going back to the Spanish, the French, and later the English arriving in the area, they came across Indian folks that were dressed using women's clothing and using men's clothing, right? So today, you know, these folks are called third spirits, but back then they were called Berdash, right? So there are these labels that show up in the historical records. For the English speakers, going back to 17th century London, there are bars where men dress like women to attract same-sex partners, and they have a word for themselves. They call themselves mollies, right? And so those words show up, right? This is not something you have to wait until Stonewall, right? This is there all the way back.
Kristen, as Victor was talking about some of this terminology that people would use to at least signal to each other what was going on, when did this start to become more, I don't know if you want to call it more mainstream or more like, you know, obviously there's the references to Stonewall and things like that. But like, when did people become more open about things like that?
There have been people who have been open and living their fully authentic lives forever. It maybe is something that straight folks or straight society has not paid as much attention to, but there have been couples who have been out in the open, or gay people or trans people who have lived that way forever. In the Wisconsin Pride documentary, we learn about Ralph Kerwinio, who lived as a trans man in 1913, 1914, 1915 in Milwaukee. That's one of the earlier documented examples that we talk about in the documentary. But there have been people who have been living openly as long as there have been people. So it might feel newer to people who perhaps haven't been studying this, researching it, who haven't had gay and trans folks in their families or that they knew personally, but it's actually not that new.
Do you think that the way history is taught to students might have something to do with that? Because certainly I nor any of my peers would have learned about this in history class in, let's say, the early 1980s.
Of course not. I mean, that this history hasn't been taught in classrooms really ever that I can think of. When my co-author and I were researching and writing We Will Always Be Here, we talked to a lot of high school students and high school teachers and parents of high school students. And this is history that isn't taught, which is really disappointing because Wisconsin itself as a state has been a real trailblazer, especially in the area of LGB rights, so gay rights. You know, we were the first state in the entire country country to pass a non-discrimination law in 1982, which was a law that had significant bipartisan support at the time. And so, you know, for Wisconsin students to not know that this is part of their own state's history is pretty sad. But that's why all these other efforts like the book and the documentary and a lot of the work that we all do is really critical to sharing with students the history of their own state. And for students who are members of the LGBTQ plus community, it's important for them to see themselves represented in history. I've heard from so many high school students, so many teenagers who have said, I didn't even know that there were gay people or queer people or trans people in Wisconsin, especially if they're from the more rural areas, and they may be one of only a few in their own little small towns. For them to know that they don't have to move to New York or San Francisco in order to live a fully authentic life is really powerful for them to see themselves represented in history and to know that they have a place in this state. Does that answer your question?
Yes, certainly. Kristen, okay. Kristen was talking about, oh, go ahead, Victor.
Yeah, I was going to follow that up. You know, professional historians at universities started this field in the 1970s and 1980s. It begins showing up, tracking up in local areas in the 1990s. Part of it is created through women's studies, right? So it's professionally, there have been historians doing this kind of work since the 1960s, I would say, right? The big issue is, does it get put on the history standards? Does it get put into the curriculum? And there, in more progressive states, people have demanded that they want to see themselves in their textbooks. They want to see themselves in the lessons. They don't want to see themselves as someone that doesn't belong, right? I mean, think about how powerful it is when you are told that you have a history. You stop being a social problem. You stop being, for lack of a better word, a problem. And now you're a person worthy of study. Think how important and validating that is, especially for young people. And for young people, I think it's very important. And I say this every time I speak publicly, right? We have reports that as many as 40 to 50% of gay teenagers attempt suicide at one point or another. And one thing that makes a big difference is if they are talked about positively, if they are talked about as something that's worthy of study, if there's something, someone that has dignity. If you have history, you have dignity, right? And, you know, pay attention. What do dictators do when they want to destroy a population? They erase their history. They erase them as people. And doing this kind of work is giving hope and telling folks that they are legitimate and that they belong. And that is why we do this kind of work.
I don't want to put words in Victor's mouth, Lauren, but one of the things that he's talking about is about visibility and is about representation in academia. And this documentary, Wisconsin Pride, seems like it will provide a lot of visibility and representation in media, which is another way in which visibility is important. So talk about a project like this Wisconsin Pride documentary and why it's so important to undertake in our state and in particular for residents in the La Crosse area.
You know, a personal passion of mine, but also a passion of the Community Foundation here in La Crosse is to tell stories that are historically untold or undertold. It's important that our mission is to enhance the quality of life in La Crosse County. And we can enhance the quality of life by showing people who are part of the LGBTQIA plus community that they have always existed here and they have always belonged here. I thought it was really, you know, Kristen said a few minutes ago that Wisconsin, I think you said, was the first state to pass non-discrimination legislation. And I can't even fathom that, right? That's not something that I was aware of prior to a couple minutes ago. And what an incredible thing for us to be able to show and teach to our young folks, especially our young LGBTQ plus folks, that they have always existed here. And their history of being in this community and in Wisconsin is that we actually have been leaders in this fight to have for equality and LGBTQ plus rights. So it's so important that we talk about those under told or untold stories so that individuals who have varying identities from, you know, the kind of cis white hetero norm will be able to also see themselves in our history and understand that they do belong, right? And it's all about helping folks know that so that we start to see the 40 to 50% of gay teens, we see that number decrease, because when you feel like you belong and you feel welcomed and loved, you're a lot less likely to feel like you need to leave this world behind.
I'm relieved, Lauren, to hear you say that you learned that fact today, because it was in preparation for this conversation, I think probably yesterday, when I was looking at the PBS Wisconsin website, where episodes of this documentary are available. And some other clips from it. There was a photo right on the front of that website, and it was people walking in a parade carrying a colorful banner that said Wisconsin, something like the original gay rights state or something like that. So that was brand new to me, and I'm relieved to know I wasn't the only one that didn't know that. That's interesting. So when you're talking about letting people know that people like them have always been here and that their stories matter. Lauren, I'm wondering, like now, is that legacy of Wisconsin as, you know, sort of the original gay rights state, if you will, is that intact? Like in the La Crosse area, is this considered to be an LGBTQ plus friendly place?
I think that depends on who you ask, Ezra.
Okay.
I really do. I think, you know, I'm a transplant to Wisconsin and grew up in Kansas, southeast corner, and super conservative background, right? So I grew up not seeing myself in history. I grew up hearing things about myself right before I had identified as part of the LGBTQ plus community, hearing things about myself that weren't positive. And when I came to Wisconsin, when I came to La Crosse, it was absolutely marketed to me as an LGBTQ person that it was a super inclusive space, right? And that hate has no home here. That's something that we are really proud of saying in La Crosse. I think it also depends on who you ask. I think there's a big population of folks who really are welcoming and inclusive and want to embrace folks. I just received an email this week from a local faith leader, and it was the first time I'd ever heard a faith leader refer to the LGBTQ community and say a phrase like, this is exactly how God created them. I'd never heard a member of the faith community say that, and that's a member of our La Crosse community, right? And so I do think that that exists here, and I think that there exists this sense of pride and that we're leading the charge in some ways, but I also think there's a large portion of the community here that would still like to erase our existence and history altogether, right? And pretend that there's that layer of Midwest nice here that I think keeps us from saying things that we'd like to say sometimes, even if those are biases. So I think that it's a little bit harder to see that hate or that bias sometimes in our local community because of our Midwest nice. But I think you really experience it if you're a member of the community that exists here. You can still feel that there's, you know, I almost feel like there's some conflicting communities and conflicting spaces, right? Where on one hand, I could be in this block and feel really welcomed and included in this space, and then walk to the next place and feel totally out of place and like I want to go home and hide. So I really think it depends on who you are and where you exist at.
Victor, what about you?
I think the experience is very different, whether you're rural-based, you're urban-based, you're middle-class, you're working-class, you're Roman Catholic, you're Lutheran, you're Jewish. You know, there's different gay worlds and with different kinds of privileges and different kinds of limitations. as we got ready to do this documentary, we contacted a lot of folks in the area that had been active in the 70s when the first real organizing happened here in the La Crosse area. And they told us great stories about how it was the local churches where they were allowed to meet. It was the local churches that helped them, right? And you stand back and say, wow, but it's a lot of these conservative Christians that are like our sworn enemies, right? So it's kind of hard to adjust and say, well, yeah, but the Episcopalians down the street were very nice, and so were the Lutherans over across the campus, right? But it was also very interesting to have people that knew a lot of history deny us access to photographs, deny having their names identified, and denied sharing with us some of their materials because they were scared. In 2023, people are still scared to come out. And I think one thing I would like to do, maybe in a future project, is to focus on some of those communities. I came here from Texas. I'm Mexican American. I came here in the year 2000. I had 70 job applications out. Three of them wanted to hire me, and I wanted to come to La Crosse because it had a lot of gay bars and because there were a lot of out people and it felt safe, right? But I also got to meet my first couple of years here, I was introduced to some fascinating people. I got to meet gay farmers. I got to meet, I walked into a farmhouse by Cashton where there were 40 gay guys aged 30 to 70. And wow, what a world. And I wish we could document that, right? You know, I want someone to do some research on the Norwegian bachelor farmer, right? How is it that these local cultures have created space for queers? I want someone to do a history on lesbians in convents. You know, there's a lot of gay history around here. And sadly, you know, one of the most fascinating figures, this guy who opened the first gay bar back in 1967, 1968, passed away during the epidemic. We don't have his story. You know, I think about him and I want to not have those stories be lost.
So he passed away recently, like during the COVID pandemic?
Yeah, he passed away during the COVID pandemic. He was already sick and was in an old folks home. Yeah. Very interesting guy. He thought he wanted to be a priest or a brother and started that, then left it, went to Vietnam and got thrown out of the army, came back to town and opened up bars. And this is the guy that actually in the 80s organized the local gay community and said, okay, we've got a dozen guys sick. They can't take care of themselves. We got to feed them. We got to make sure they get their medicine. We got to make sure they're not evicted. We got to take care of them, right? These are important people. These are our heroes. And, you know, we haven't heard his name. We don't know who he is, right? So those are also important folks to look out for and to document. Because, you know, I want that kid who is being bullied in the seventh grade at the in one of our own neighborhoods to know that it gets better and that people like him can achieve great things.
We're talking about the PBS Wisconsin documentary Wisconsin Pride today on Newsmakers. Our guests are Victor Macias Gonzalez, whom you've just heard from, Kristen Whitson and Lauren Juno. And of course, I can barely speak. And so I think I mispronounced Victor's name earlier, but we'll get it right going forward. And if you'd like to check me on that, you can listen to this conversation online. It's at WPR.org/newsmakers. That's WPR.org/newsmakers. Our conversation will continue in just a moment here on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall here in our studios on the campus of UW-La Crosse, continuing our conversation about Wisconsin Pride, which is a new documentary about the lives and the history of LGBTQ plus people in Wisconsin. And in particular, today we're talking about statewide, of course, but focusing on southwestern Wisconsin, our listenership in the La Crosse area, and how people around here would have known about the figures discussed in this documentary. We're talking with Victor Macias Gonzalez from the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. We're talking to author Kristen Whitson, and we're also talking to Lauren Juneau from the La Crosse Community Foundation. And we were talking about the experiences, and Lauren said when I asked about whether this is an LGBTQ-friendly area here in southwestern Wisconsin, Lauren said it depends on who you ask. And so, Kristen, I didn't quite get around to you on that part of the conversation. So I'm wondering, like, what, you know, we're no longer like taking fire hoses to people or some of these horrible things that have happened in the past in our country. But what does discrimination look like now in 2023?
That's a good question. I think it can be much more insidious and quiet than we think of discrimination as. And Lauren mentioned our sort of veneer of Midwest nice that happens here in Wisconsin. And that can mean that people aren't open about their biases, but it can also mean that they may be supportive privately of their own LGBTQ plus family members, but then they stay pretty quiet when members of the community are openly or publicly discriminated against. And I think that is probably the most dangerous form of discrimination, the private support and public silence. And so I think that that's a lot of what discrimination looks like today, or not showing up to the school board meetings or the library board meetings where a few very loud conservative, radically conservative activists are seeking to ban books or ban a particular type of history. To stay home and stay away from those people because they seem loud and scary just permits those voices to fill the silence then. And it doesn't take a huge amount of bravery or it doesn't take a lot of confrontation to just show up in numbers to counteract those type of messages. And I feel like that's also, to not show up is a really dangerous form of not supporting the community. And to just show up is a really powerful form of support.
So I don't, we also need answer. Them to show up to vote.
Yes.
They also need to show up to vote.
Yes. I don't know if that answered your question, Ezra.
Yeah.
I think discrimination today can also be really loudly obvious. So far, this hasn't happened in Wisconsin because we have a governor who will veto any of the more dangerous, awful bills, like keeping youth and adults from gender-affirming medical care, So we might think that it's not happening here, but there are some folks who are pretty interested in making sure that trans people right now is what's in the news, can't comfortably exist in public. My concern, and I think the way that it's going, is that once trans people can no longer exist in public, then LGBTQ people are the next ones on the list. And so to answer your question, I think there can be some really loud and ugly forms of discrimination, but that's not nearly as prevalent as the really sort of quiet, silent forms of discrimination.
So I'm curious to know, about, you talked about people going to school board meetings and some of these local voices that we might hear. There's also been a lot of attention paid to what books and other material are available to young people. And I mean, obviously everything we give to young people should be age appropriate, whatever kind of sexuality or whatever it's about. But like there's this whole notion that just the mere fact of being gay or trans or something like that is not family-friendly material or is not age-appropriate. And I'm curious about what that does to the psyche of people who are part of that community. How is it if you're constantly being fed this message of, you know, we're not talking about specific sexual acts, but the fact of talking about like a story about a child having two mothers or two fathers or something like that is considered not family friendly. How should people react to that?
Public schools have to teach children to get along. The lesson is taught very early. Respect others, respect yourself, get along. We are a republic. We all help each other, right? And that is a lesson that children are taught from kindergarten, right? And in more progressive cities, in larger urban settings with more educated populations, there are inclusive curricula that teach those lessons to children. You don't want your child to have that kind of education. You want your child to grow up in a place where it's okay to be nasty to others. You want your own child to be targeted because they lisp, because they are missing a limb, because their eye is different. Go ahead. Let them pick on one. It's going to come back to you, right? So we want the schools to be a safe place for everyone. And we know from scientific studies that not being mentioned in the curriculum, not being reflected in the lessons, erases you, makes you feel like you don't belong, makes you feel like you are not worthy. You were asking the other folks about experiences of discrimination. Well, mm-hmm. You know, I'm a gay Mexican-American, and I can talk to you about discrimination in many ways. One of the most horrible kinds of discrimination that I have seen was an experience I had with a close friend. This is a friend who graduated from UW La Crosse with a degree in teaching. Very, very bright person. And he struggled for about 2 years to look for a job at the La Crosse area. He interviewed as far away as Madison, and he not once got a callback. He would get invited to come be a substitute teacher, but he was not invited back to be an instructor, a full-time instructor with benefits. And back then with union protection, this is before it went away. And the reason why we think is because he presents in a more effeminate way. And local folks who are interviewing him just did not give him a chance, right? And this is a person that has subsequently gone on to be very successful in a larger city. And is talked to speak in national settings about the teaching experience and diversity. And unfortunately, you know, La Crosse could benefit from that, but passed up on it, right? So it's a bigger loss.
It's interesting to hear you say that, and it just highlights Lauren's earlier point of that kind of discrimination is different depending on who you are, and everybody's experience is different, isn't it?
And it's one of those more silent forms of discrimination. It's not that, Victor, I'm guessing nobody called and said, we're not going to hire you because you're an effeminate gay guy. They just didn't call back, or they just didn't answer. They just didn't hire him. Our book has not been actively banned anywhere. There are just school districts and libraries that don't order it. And nobody's calling us and saying that there's anything wrong with our book, which, by the way, is written for teenagers, but is entirely age appropriate. There's nothing graphic or sexual about it. It's just the history of activism. There's no discussion of anybody's bedroom habits whatsoever. which has an important place in time, but not for teenagers. Anyways, these are some of the more silent forms of discrimination that I'm talking about. Because nobody's calling me and saying, we can't give your book to teenagers because school board members or library board members will fire us all if we do that. They're just not ordering the book, not giving it to teenagers.
So there's it's almost like a subversive censorship in a way. In that there, nobody's coming to school board meetings saying, get rid of this book. It's just not being purchased in the first place.
Right.
I mean, it really is the norm for our communities, right? And I think that's where you get to the passive aggressive Midwest nice, where people aren't necessarily coming out and saying, you're not welcome here because you're part of this community. But if you're a member of that community, not seeing yourself in spaces, not being able to see yourself in history, there's a large part of the population that I still hear things like, oh, we didn't have people like that in my day, right? We were following the scripture, or we were doing things right. The world has gotten worse, and that's why we see these people doing these things. That's simply not true. We've been here, we've existed. And when someone says that, I think it's really important to note that if you haven't seen a population of individuals, that likely is your privilege, right? You've grown up in a space where you didn't have to see those individuals. You didn't have to see the social problems that they endure. You don't have to hear those stories because they are underrepresented, undertold, right? And so I think that makes a difference too, right? Telling these stories and being able to educate individuals who still have a really ignorant mindset that people choose a lifestyle because they don't want to do what's right, right? Those kinds of mindsets are also what have to be shifted. And I'm really excited for this documentary because it's an opportunity to combat that in a Midwest nice way, right? Teach the history and just show people that they're wrong, not by saying you're wrong, but by saying, let me show you all of the LGBTQ history in this community and how rich it is, and how our communities wouldn't be built in the way that they're built today without this population and community of folks who have contributed so magically to the diversity of culture and artistic expression and creation and innovation and everything else in our communities.
Well, and it strikes me that in terms of just creating a more welcoming space for all people, you don't have to constantly walk around in public beating yourself on the head saying we did wrong, or just start doing different. Like,
just start doing right. Yeah. When we know better, we do better, right?
That's right.
And that makes us better humans. And we're all supposed to grow. We're not supposed to stay stagnant and just hold the beliefs that we've had since we popped out of the womb, right? We're supposed to grow, and we're supposed to move forward in our journeys and continue to learn and evolve. And there's no ever having arrived when it comes to learning about these issues and becoming a better community member and a better neighbor. And so I think this is a really great opportunity for not only for the LGBTQ community and its youth to feel represented and feel seen, but it's an opportunity for everyone else in the community who hasn't been exposed, who hasn't had to be exposed, who's had the privilege of not having to learn these stories or not even having to consider if they have a history, right? Because they fit into that norm. Those are the folks too, that it's just as important that we educate those individuals so that they start to see that this community and population of folks that maybe they've had held a bias against or not allowed to allowed them to be as visible. We're not invisible. We're here, we've existed, and we have for centuries, right? And so allow us to just exist. That's all anyone wants.
Are there specific characters, maybe from this area or maybe throughout Wisconsin, who are known? Are there names people should know of people who are attached to Wisconsin or to southwestern Wisconsin specifically that represent LGBTQ plus life in this part of the world?
Yeah, Michael P. Hansen, who is the person I mentioned earlier. He is a local boy who opened up the first gay bar in 1967 and kept operating gay bars up all through the 1990s. He also started the Red Ribbon Fund to help folks who were stricken by AIDS back before we had treatment. Big philanthropist. His nickname in the community was Mother. And I think that tells you a lot about him and his impact in the community.
Who else is, I know a name that comes up in lacrosse a lot for his athletic accomplishments is George Pogue. He's mentioned in this documentary.
You know, I think the thing about George Pogue, right, is that not only is he recognized for being the first African-American to win an Olympic medal, but also, right, was maybe one of the first LGBTQ members of the community to win a medal. That is very little known. His identity when it comes to being part of the LGBTQ plus community really wasn't discovered until after his death. And so you'll see in the documentary that there was, you'll hear folks talk about how much care they took in researching his life and wanting to be careful that they didn't out someone posthumously, right? That can cause a lot of damage for individuals or their family members or, but I think it's a really beautiful thing that there was, I think it was a great nephew of George's that after his passing told folks, you know, my uncle was a gay man and finally said those words out loud, which allowed us to then embrace his history as also being LGBTQ plus history, and which is all of our history, right? Because just the change of his identity to being one of a member of the LGBTQ community doesn't change the fact that he made all of these incredible athletic accomplishments for our community and representing lacrosse. And I think it just adds to the enrichment of that story and makes just his life and his journey so much more magical and incredible to learn about that he also existed in a world where LGBTQ folks were not welcome to be out. And it was dangerous for him to be involved as a Black man in general, right? But to also be a member of the LGBTQ community as a member of the Black African-American community.
Who are some others that people should be looking up to as trailblazers in this movement in Wisconsin?
That's a great question. And I really want to take the opportunity to talk about the lesbian community in lacrosse, which is hugely important, relatively private because they don't necessarily want to be all out and about, especially some of the older generation. But one person in particular and her work is Mary O'Sullivan with the Leaping Lacrosse News, which is a publication that was written for and by lesbians starting in 1980. And all of the back issues, by the way, I say this as a totally self-interested archivist, all of these are available digitally through the UW Lacrosse Archives and also through Recollection Wisconsin. So if you look those up, if you look up the Leaping Lacrosse News, you'll find all of these back issues. And Mary O'Sullivan also appears in the documentary, and what she talks about, and this is really important, is that the lesbians just continued to find each other throughout the 80s and the 90s, still today, but in particular in the 80s and 90s. Actually, in the very early, the late 1990s or the early 2000s, there was a nationwide lesbian magazine called Girlfriends Magazine that listed lacrosse as the fifth best place in the country for lesbians to live. And that was largely in part, largely due to these women who came together to, you know, sign themselves up for potlucks, to have sports leagues, to have book clubs, to really just form community with each other, to form family with each other. This is something I think that LGBTQ plus people, members of this community do really well, is we form our own families, we form our own communities, we form our own connections with each other. We learn pretty quickly that blood family can be important, can be supportive. We also find our own family members, our own communities, our own really deep connections with each other in ways other than blood-related family. And so the Leaping Lacrosse News was one really important way that that happened here in South Central, Southwestern Wisconsin.
Very interesting. Before we go, I want to talk again, remind people we're talking about this documentary called Wisconsin Pride that has been produced by PBS Wisconsin, and it premieres on next Tuesday. And so you can watch it on PBS Wisconsin or catch it on the PBS Passport or on the PBS Wisconsin website. But speaking specifically of the documentary, Victor, we'll start with you, and we'll see how much time we have. What do you hope people take away from watching Wisconsin Pride?
Wow, I think I want people to walk away feeling included, feeling like a portion of their story has been told. The folks who organized the project, Andy Soth, I want to give a call out to him, were vehement, making sure that we told many different kinds of stories. At one, we had a very inclusive advisory council, folks from all parts of the state. A lot of resources were put into making sure that we told as good and as deep of a story as we could. So I definitely want people to walk away about that, knowing about that. But I also want young folks who are meeting and learning about being gay online and not doing it in physical space, occupying a physical space, to realize how we old timers used to do things, what an important place gay bars, gay bookstores, lesbian bars, lesbian bookstores were, and how that might be a part of our historical heritage that needs more attention. These weren't just places where you went to drink. These were the heart of our communities. And, you know, Wisconsin has a strong drinking culture. Truth be is we have very small houses and we can't afford to heat a big house. So we socialize in the long winter months in a bar, right? And that's where you built your community. That's where you went after work. That's where you found someone to share an apartment with. That's where you found out about a job, right? And that's also where people organized and had meetings and created organizations, right? Those were our quote unquote underground railroad. And we need to honor those spaces and places and learn more about them.
The documentary is called Wisconsin Pride, and it airs on Tuesday on PBS Wisconsin. Our guests today, Victor Macias Gonzalez is a professor of history and women's gender and sexuality studies at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. Victor, thanks very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. I really enjoyed sharing my thoughts with you.
Lauren Juno is with the La Crosse Community Foundation, and that organization, in addition to the other great work they do in our community, was an important fiscal partner on this documentary. Lauren, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Ezra. I appreciate you prioritizing and highlighting this part of our history.
Certainly, certainly. Kristen Whitson is an author and archivist, and she's the co-author of We Will Always Be Here, a guide to exploring and understanding the history of LGBTQ+ activism in Wisconsin. Kristen, thanks a lot for your time today.
Thanks for having us, Ezra. This is great.
There are a couple of opportunities each week to hear newsmakers. We're on Friday morning at 10 on the Ideas Network 90.3. We're on Friday night at 7 on NPR News and Music 88.9. And we're always online at WPR.org/newsmakers. If you want to reach out to our show, you can do that any day of the week, newsmakers@WPR.org. That's newsmakers@WPR.org. For my producer, Kate Spranger, I'm Ezra Wall. We'll see you next time on another Newsmakers right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.